Week. There'll be three special days, and everyone obviously knows that they're happening. Just want to encourage you all to invest in them as much as you can. Yom HaShoah will be light programming here, and those of you who went to Poland, those of you who are going to Poland, you'll really have intense programming available. Yom HaAtzmaut is probably obvious to you, and it's easy to get caught up in the spirit, and that's something you need a lot of prefatory discussions about, although next week the Chog will be dedicated to Yom HaAtzmaut. We'll get you in the mood of Yom HaAtzmaut. But the day that I want you to really pay attention to and really make sure you follow the guidance of the yeshiva and go to all the program is Yom HaZikaron. Yom HaZikaron is probably the day which has the biggest offset between what goes on in Eretz Yisrael and what goes on in Chutz La'aretz, for obvious reasons, because here it's very visceral, it's very vivid. Everyone knows someone or knows someone who knows someone. It's a very, very spiritual day, Yom HaZikaron. People really go through a 24-hour catharsis, which many liken to something akin. Obviously, it's very different. One is national, one is religious, but something akin to Yom Kippur, where you walk out feeling purged and feeling that there's a higher framework that unites us all. And we're going to try to contribute as many programs as we can to you. I'll try to provide some videos for you to watch. But really, next week, Monday, try to take your time and invest in Yom HaZikaron. You'll find it's vastly, vastly different than any approximate programming you've had in Chutz La'aretz. And it's the approximate Yom HaAtzmaut. So this will be decibel level 15, and you are decibel level 7. Or the Yom HaShoah, this will be decibel level 10. But the Yom HaZikaron is a very, very different fabric. But let's focus on Parshas Emor this week. Next week, we'll get a little bit to Yom HaZikaron and to Yom HaAtzmaut. I'll mention a little bit about the Shoah tonight, because it is Yom HaShoah. But if Kantom, he spoke about it, those who went to his Chog, there'll be other programming available. Let's really focus on the Parsha. I'll reference it perhaps here or there if it comes up. Parshas Emor describes Korbanos. And obviously, Korbanos have been described in detail in Parshas Vayikra and Parshas Tzav, the beginning of Sefer Vayikra. But in Parshas Emor, there's a very clear description as to which types of animals can be offered and which by extension or by negation, by exclusion, can't be offered, especially in the wake of Shmini. Before Shmini, at least literarily, we're not aware of which animals are permissible to eat. But after Shmini, evidently, there are many more animals which can be eaten aside from the standard oxen, sheep, and goats that seem to dominate the korbanos selection of Vayikra and Tzav. There's venison, there's deer, there's all types of chayos, which again, we don't eat that much of, so we're not that familiar with, we don't come into contact with, but there are many types of non-domesticated behemos which can be offered, which can be eaten, yet none of them can factor into korbanos. So there's a very nice medrash in Parshas Emor that sees the selection of these three quote-unquote boring domesticated animals as iconic, as suggesting a message far beyond korbanos. Obviously, we don't live in a world of korbanos anymore, but we're trying to snatch some of the ideas which serve as the foundation of korbanos and apply them even beyond the Mizbeach, even beyond the Beis HaMikdash. Meretz Hashem, now after Pesach, we're in the build-up for Shemitah. Now that Pesach has passed, a lot of people in this country are thinking about Shemitah. On the one hand, a lot of people in Chutz La'aretz, and I hope that many of you will undergo this attitude. Why is it so complicated in Israel? In South Africa, in Johannesburg, we can just eat whatever we want. In Teaneck, we can eat whatever we want. We don't have to worry about the Shemitah thing and how to separate potatoes and how to separate onions and where to put the peels. You'll see there'll be a lot of, even at your level, in which your meals are prepared for you, there'll be a lot of quote-unquote inconveniences that you'll have to face living next year through Shemitah. You can't just treat Shemitah produce the way you treat regular produce. So a lot of people shy away. Life in Israel is so complicated. That's a very foul attitude to have. This is an opportunity to be mekayem mitzvos. Mitzvos that for thousands of years have been forsaken. Even if the mitzvos hadn't been forsaken, there's still mitzvos that occupy central swaths of the Torah. And the fact that halacha complicates your life, if your whole purpose of life is just to eat as quickly as possible and as much as possible, then you're right, it's a complication. If your purpose in life is to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and these are mitzvahs that you believe Hashem intended for our good, for the world's good, for societal good, for national welfare, so it should be your honor to be here during the year of Shemitah. It should be your honor to be here when you have extra halachas, even if you're not in a Shemitah year, even if you're in a non-Shemitah year and you have to worry about trumos and maestros, or even, and this is already foreshadowing Yom HaAtzmaut, even if you're here in just the struggle to find different levels of kashrus. I do trust this kashrus. I don't trust this kashrus. I can only eat this type of meat. Where you come from, you don't have those problems. All the meat has a certain level of kashrus. You don't have to worry about it. You walk into the store, everything is kosher. Why do you think that's true? Because in Johannesburg, the mashgiach has one and only one concern, that all the Orthodox Jews in Johannesburg should eat kosher. So he walks into the meat slaughter home. In America, obviously, kashrus is bigger business because you've got millions and millions of people that eat kosher. So let's talk about the American example just to show you how macroeconomical these questions are. So if you go to a major food distributor like Coca-Cola and you say, well, we represent 5 million people who will only drink Coca-Cola if it's kosher, then Coca-Cola has to make a decision whether it's worth it for them economically to pay a full-time mashgiach. And in most cases, they make the decision that it is worth it. So who has leverage? Who's in the driver's seat? The mashgiach, the kashrus organization. These are our standards. Baltimore has a lot of kashrus organizations. Are you in kashrus? No. These are our standards. And if you meet our standards, we'll give you our label. If you don't meet our standards, we won't give the label. Because the mashgiach in Chutz Laaretz, or the kashrus organization in Chutz Laaretz, has one and only one concern. Making that cup of Coca-Cola, making that sandwich, making that cheese as kosher as possible. And he has consumers behind him. In this country, the scales of kashrus negotiations are reversed. Because let's say the Rabbanim meets with Tenuva. Tenuva, let's say, is the national supplier of poultry, of fruits, of produce, of vegetables, of milk. We want Tenuva to be kosher, because there are millions of Jews that aren't interested necessarily in keeping kosher, but we want them to be kosher. We want this to be a kosher state. We want this to be a state in which most people, let's say, go out of their way, are going to eat kosher. Most people today have to go out of your way not to be kosher. You have to find the place that serves non-kosher milk and find the place that serves Chametz on Pesach. We're proud of the fact that we have a state that, by and large, obviously people mix meat and milk and they're not makbidon b'shal hakum, but by and large, people aren't eating tarfus min hatara in this country. You have to go out of your way to try to make things straight for this country. So Tenuva knows that the Rabbanim have to walk out of that meeting with a heksher in their hands. They can't walk away by saying, look, you didn't meet our standards, we're not going to give you a heksher. The Rabbanim need Tenuva to be kosher in the end of the day. So who's got the leverage? Not the Rabbanim, but Tenuva. So that's why many of the national kashrus standards in this country are very, very low in their standards, because the Rabbanim don't have any leverage. They don't have any poker chips. They can't say, oh, we want you to be makbid on this, and we want you to be careful about this. They can only achieve a very, very low level of kashrus. Which is why for most things like candy and potato chips and spaghetti and most dairy products and most cereals, it's all right. So it's very hard to make these things straight as long as they're meeting minimum standards. That's why a lot of people are more vigilant about meats and certain types of cheeses and obviously vegetables because of the insect issue and red meat and chickens. So obviously living in Eretz Yisrael means you don't just walk into any restaurant and eat wherever you want. You try to find out the kashrus, try to find out the person behind the counter. But the complications of keeping kashrus in Eretz Yisrael are reflective that our kashrus consciousness is not just local, how kosher is my plate, but our kashrus consciousness now is national. I'm not just concerned with my plate, I'm concerned with millions of people's plates that are part of my equation. That's part of a national experience, a national identity. It's not enough to know that your plate is as kosher as possible. You have to be concerned with millions of people and what's on their plate. And that may crimp, or that may somehow impact your level of kashrus, but that's part of living in Eretz Yisrael. Similarly, living through Shemitah. We'll talk about Shemitah as the time grows near, and as Hetem Mechira starts to be a discussion and be an issue that we have to struggle with. But living through Shemitah is living through halachic opportunity. And halachic opportunity is a challenge, and halachic challenge is something that a religious person wants to embrace, not flee from. So, talking about kashrus, we don't really eat too many meats. We eat basically cow meat and sheep and lamb. But why don't we bring karbanos in these wild, non-domesticated animals? If anything, they'd be very colorful. People should bring whatever carbon they want. Be very vivid. Imagine Captain Ahab. Any Captain Ahabs here? You can chase down Moby Dick all over the Pacific Ocean, capture a humpback whale, capture a sperm whale, capture a blue whale, tow it thousands of kilometers to the port in Haifa, lug it to the Beis HaMikdash and slit its belly with all the blubber falling over the Mizbeach. What a demonstration of my commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that I sacrifice Moby Dick for the Rabboni Shalom. I go out to the jungles of India and I find a Manchurian tiger and I lasso it and grab it around the neck and I bring it into the Beis HaMikdash roaring and screaming and I slit its throat and its blood comes pouring out. This is a come on, there's got to be some excitement, some electricity, some spontaneity. Why the korban is so boring? Why the domesticated animals? So there are two medrashim I want to discuss with you tonight. One is at the top of your page. As I mentioned earlier, the challenge is to turn korbanos into something iconic so you can borrow its meaning and apply it to your everyday non-mikdash life. As I was about to say before, I forgot the same thing with Shemitah. None of us are farmers, very few of us are going to be in the fields planting or not planting, but there's certain core values of Shemitah that are exportable, that are can be extrapolated from the agricultural context and applied to social context, our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to our relationship to land and country and people. And next year we'll start to study these, even though we're not farmers, try to make Shemitah real. What are some of those values about Shemitah or within Shemitah that could be exported outside the context of Shemitah? So what are the values of carbon selection that can be exported outside of Karbanos proper? So let's read this first Medrash. Mashal Amelech. The Medrash talks about a parable to a king who sends a scroll with his royal decree, the constitution of his kingdom, he sends to his population. It's called in the Medrash a prosdogma. It's basically a scroll that has the basics of what it means to pledging allegiance to the king, and he expects it to be read every day. So what happens? The population grabs the scroll, pour it open in public center, shaking and shivering while they're reading it, because this represents the authority of the king. We don't really know what kings are, which is what makes these parables so oblique to us, because we don't have absolute authorities in our world anymore. We can't be put to death with impunity or arbitrarily. But kings had that capacity. You lived in mortal fear of a king, because he could put you to death based on whim and caprice. So you grab that scroll of the king, and you start shaking when you read it. Hashem says, that's not how I see religion. I don't want you to shake. I don't want you to shake and shiver when you read my constitution. What's the constitution of Judaism? Where are the basic tenets of Judaism outlined? Kriyat Shema. Kriyat Shema is a three-part section. Part number one describes theology. What does it mean to be theologically sound, to believe that Hashem is Echad, that Hashem is indivisible, that Hashem is exclusive, to love and fear Hashem, to translate concept and belief into emotion. And the third part of that first section of theology is Torah, to study Torah and to know Hashem. You can't know God without studying His Word. You can't just try to comprehend God, not comprehend it. You can't comprehend God in human terms. The best way you can comprehend the Kodesh Baruch Hu is V'shinantam levanecha, V'dibarta b'am, Shiftecha b'veisecho, V'lechtecha v'aderech. The second section of Kriya Shema is the second section of the Jewish Constitution. It describes transitioning from belief, which is the first section, into practice. You can't just be a Jew who believes. You have to actually practice mitzvahs. V'hayam shema'a, Tishmoel mitzvotai, asher anochi mitzvotcham hayom. So the first section of Kriya Shema is theology, indivisibility, exclusivity, love, passion, fear, study of Torah. Second section is practice. Some people excel in the first section. They believe, but they can't translate it into action and obedience. Some people are very successful at obedience, but they don't have that theological basis. They follow every single part of Shulchan Aruch, but when you ask them, tell me about your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, do you believe in Hashem? They have a hard time. It's hard for them to extrapolate beyond just the myopic activities. And the third section of Kriya Shema is believing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes in our world. He's part of our world. And the first time Hashem became part of our world was 2,500 years after He created it, when He intervened supernaturally in Mitzrayim, and He proved to us that He's really behind the scenes in all the comings and goings and operations of our world. Now, when Hashem tells us to read Kriya Shema, it's a very interesting phraseology which describes Kriya Shema. V'shachtecha uvekumecha. V'shiftecha v'veisecha uvelechtecha v'aderech uvshachtecha. Now, there are a lot of halachos which are derived from these phrases. But from a literary standpoint, it appears as if the recitation of Kriya Shema is meant to be very casual. You're sitting at home. You're on the road. You're lying down. You're standing up. Now, in fact, there's a very interesting machlokas between Beishama and Beisila. Beis Shammai wanted to formalize Kriya Shema recital. Beis Shammai wanted to say at night, you have to say Kriya Shema lying down. Beis Hillel said, during the morning, you have to say Kriya Shema standing up, because it says, B'shach b'cho v'kumecha, while you're lying down and while you're standing up. And Beis Hillel was adamant, you can't formalize Kriya Shema. Kriya Shema is not meant to be formalized. Say Kriya Shema however you want. Standing, sitting, lying, leaning. B'shach b'cho v'kumecha doesn't mean while you're physically in a state of reclining or a state standing up, like Ari, isn't it? Helping out there. But b'shach b'cho means zman shchiva. When people go to sleep, then you should recite Kriya Shema at night. Uvizman kima. When people wake up, you should recite Kriya Shema. In fact, there was one of the Chazal, I think it was Reb Shimon, Reb Shimon Gamliel, who actually practiced like Beis Shammai, and they said Yechayiv Misa. This is such an important machlokes between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel that they were hyperbolic and trying to deny people the option of holding like Beis Shammai. Because when you're reciting the constitution of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem says, I don't want you to be shaking and shivering. I don't want you to be standing at attention. I want you to be calm, relaxed, and casual. We'll read this in a second, but you should know halachically. Akiva is sitting in the back, Akiva Martyr. So one of Akiva's Rebbeim in the high school he went to was a Rebbe named Rabbi Jackter. So he wrote an article many, many years ago on the difference between Kriya Shema and Tefillah. That when you're davening, you're supposed to be standing at attention, you're supposed to be standing, we call it Amida. Tefillah Shemon Esrei is very formalized. There are a lot of halachas about not speaking in the middle of Shemon Esrei, whereas Kriya Shema is the opposite. When you're talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and asking for your request, you have to have that sense that you're standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Malach Malach Elach, and have gravitas. At Kriya Shema, you shouldn't be flipping, you shouldn't be goes and walk, you shouldn't be in another place. But Kriya Shema, for example, if someone comes to talk to you in the middle of Kriya Shema, under certain conditions, you're allowed to answer. Certain conditions, the Gemara Baruch Hu talks about, Shalom Abnei HaKavod, Meishim Abnei HaYira, even in the middle of Kriya Shema proper, under certain circumstances. The Gemara says that if a snake happens to be attacking you during Shemon Esrei, afilu nachash karach ala kevo, even if a snake is wrapping himself around your ankle, you're not supposed to stop Shemon Esrei. Again, under certain conditions, but Kriya Shema, you're allowed to stop for certain conditions. So Kriya Shema is meant to be casual, and the casual nature of Kriya Shema is conveyed by the text, b'shach b'cha v'kumecha, b'shiftecha b'veisecha, uvalachtecha v'aderech, and halachically, that the laws of Shemon Esrei, which formalize the recital of Shemon Esrei, don't apply to Kriya Shema. Now, what does this have to do with Parshas Emor? Let's see. So Hashem says, let's read. Source number 1, part 3. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael. Hashem tells the Jewish people, Pros dogma didi, my constitution, my scroll, lo hitrachti aleichem. I didn't tell you, lo amarti aleichem, shneikorim Kriya Shema, lo umdim arachleichem. You have to be standing on your feet, shaking and shivering. Velo paranis rosheichem, line 4, not pulling your hair out, line 5. Veshit v'chei v'secha, uvelachtecha v'derach, uveshach v'cha v'kumecha. What does this have to do with Parshas Emor? Let's see. Now Rabbi Yehudas ben Simon says, the same way Hashem didn't want us to say Kriya Shema, shaking and shivering, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the same message, is a parallelism between two messages. There are 10 animals that you can eat. 7 of them are non-domesticated, deer, buffalo, certain types of buffalo. 3 of them are domesticated, oxen, sheep, and goats. Shem says, 4 lines from the bottom, Asara mina behemos misarti lecha. There are 10 animals that you can eat. Shlosha b'shuscha, 3 are domesticated, Zayin eina b'shuscha. Shlosha b'shuscha, 3 lines from the bottom, Shor, an ox, Seh, a sheep, Sekubasek, a sheep, Veseh izim, and a goat. Zayin eina b'shuscha. There are 7 animals that you can eat that aren't non-domesticated. What are they? Ayal, Tzvi, Yachmor, Akko, Dishon, To, Zemer. Many of these animals wouldn't even know. Hashem says, Lo hitrachti alechem, v'lo amarti alechem litagea biharim, lahavi lefanai karban. Don't think that to bring a karban you have to go through the mountains and the hills and the deserts and trap these wild animals and go hunting for them and trapping them in the forests. Just bring a carbon from what's in your backyard. That's which grows naturally. Shor o kesef away. So Parshas Emor, bring a shor, bring a kesef, bring this. Namely, the Medrash creates a parallel between the types of carbonos we select, domesticated animals as opposed to wild animals, and the way we recite Kriya Shema. What's this parallel? What's happening in this Medrash? The Medrash is describing two related modalities of that religion. One is level of effort. Hashem doesn't want you to think that to be religious, to bring a karban, to recite Kriya Shema, two different modalities for religion. You've got to stand up at attention and work hard. You've got to go trapping 3 days on a hunting expedition to find animals in some game reserve in South Africa or something. Just go to your backyard. Take a goat. Take a sheep. Take an ox and bring it as a carpet. Hashem doesn't want you to think that to say Kriya Shema you have to stand up at attention and shake and shiver. Sometimes religion seems very imposing. Sometimes religion seems very challenging. I'm sure a lot of you are thinking about that. Every time you transition in and out of yeshiva, you leave yeshiva for 3 weeks or so, you start thinking about what does religion mean? What are the expectations of religion? What are the challenges of getting up so early? What are the challenges of being up so late? What are the challenges of spending so much time studying Torah? What are the connotations for the rest of my life, the rest of my future? Hashem does not want religion to be cast at a level of difficulty that's superhuman, that overwhelms the human spirit. Just go into your backyard. Just go into your backyard and take whatever animals. Just say Kriya Shema leisurely, casually. But there's a deeper message, and it's related to the first message, but it's a more important message. If you were to bring a carbon from mountains, jungles, forests, and deserts, you would say as follows. This is really more important than the first message. I can't be religious in the here and now. The here and now is so mundane, is so dry, is so pedestrian. Religion is somewhere out there. I got to go somewhere else. Geographically and experientially. I have to go to a mountain to find religion. I have to go to a desert to find religious opportunity. I have to be something else. I have to transform myself into something else. The me that I know is too drab for real religious growth. The here and now, my home. What happens in my home? I raise kids. I take out the garbage. I raise livestock. That's not a holy place. It's not a sacred environment. I have to find some other reality and replace it with my current reality. Because the current me is not the material for religious growth or religious excellence. James says, no, that's artificial. Thinking that religion is out there, that creates compartmentalized religion. That creates autistic religion. Where your own reality isn't religious, but you become religious by finding some other places you can be religious and growing. I don't want you to go out there to mountains and forests. I want you to take your reality, who you are, your home identity, your home base, your home page in your own mind's computer, and your own mind's iPhone, or your own mind's Android, and make that religious. I don't want religion to be going out there and finding animals you have nothing to do with on a daily basis. I don't want religion to be so artificial that you stand at attention and you recite Krishna. Sometimes standing at attention is good because it creates intensity and pitch, excitement, and energy. But the downside of that is that it's not real. It's not fused to your reality. You don't stand at attention all day. How do we live our lives? We get up. And that's really the challenge of religion. The challenge of religion is to have a little bit of Kriya Shema and a little bit of Shemon Esrei in your life, a little bit of each modality. It's very easy to be firm in shul. It's very easy to be firm in the Beis Medrash. It's very easy to be firm when you're doing a mitzvah. It's a lot harder to be firm in your day-to-day boring reality because it's not as obvious. It's more subtle, moral, kind, fearing Hashem. Remember, Avram develops the pinnacle of his firmkeit on Har Moriah, on a mountain, far away from civilization, in a different place, a different time, different altitude. Yitzchak encounters HaKadosh Baruch Hu not on a mountain, but in a field. What does a field mean? Those days a field was a factory. Those days a field was the office. Yitzchak is being able to transform religion and infuse it, not just on some distant mountain, which is high, and which is exalted, but which is detached from reality. Yitzchak is able to breathe religion into the field of Yitzchak. Yaakov. What does the Gemara say? Who knows? Where is Yaakov able to breathe religion into? Not the Har, not the Sada. What? The Ba'as. He builds homes. He's the first person to build Sukkos, but even as Sukkos in Parshas V'Yishlah. Chazal are very aware of this transition. It's very easy to be super firm when you're standing on top of the mountain. But can you then transfer your firmkeit and your religious interest into the field where you work? Can you transfer that religious interest into your home environment? Very easy to be firm in shul, very easy to be firm in the Beis Medrash, very easy to be firm in yeshiva. But are you able to transfer that into a more holistic reality? And Hashem is telling us by Kriya Shema, yeah, if you stand up at attention to Kriya Shema, I'll be intense, I'll be raw, I'll be powerful, I'll be profound. But then you walk away from that moment, you'll sit down, and none of that religious energy will impact or will transfer to your day-to-day routine. So Hashem says, I just want you to say Kriya Shema, b'shivchah b'meisecha, however you want, leisurely. Because I want you to be able to think about religion not just as some artificial escape into some other reality. I was thinking a lot about this Eretz Yisrael this week. I'm thinking about Yom HaTzmon a lot this week. So I'll say something which is meant to, just to bring it back to Yom HaSamud, and maybe we'll talk a little bit later about something that can bring it back to Yom HaShoah. I like to tell some of my friends, you know the reason I made Aliyah? I'll say it to you in comical terms, then I'll say it to you in real terms. The reason I made Aliyah is because when I was in yeshiva, I went to see movies. Remember those days we had to go to a movie theater to see movies. What do I mean? I didn't spend my time seeing movies. I spent most of my time in yeshiva, learning, davening, working on my midos. But a lot of my friends, when they came to Israel, said, oh, this is a holy place. This is a place that I can't even imagine watching a movie, because I'm standing in a Beis Hashem in Eretz Yisrael, which I found to be very impressive at the time. But it created a disconnect, because these were boys who watched movies before they came to Israel. They watched movies when they came back from Israel. So Israel became a fantasy land. So if Israel is a fantasy land, so it's a place that you go for a year or two to live out your fantasies, and then you continue on with reality. I was always trying to make Israel reality. And as a real experience, I tried to copy as best as I could the experiences that I had before Eretz Yisrael, that I knew I would have after Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael. And I was able to sew it into the fabric of who I was a lot more integrally, because it was part of who I was. Now, obviously, it's not the movies that made me make Aliyah, but it was the overall orientation of what's watching movies from time to time was just a part of my identity. Remember, about 19, 18 years ago, I met Aliyah, a Rebbe that I was very close with in Chutz Lanz. I met him when I came back to the United States, and he said, I'm living in Eretz Yisrael now. I'd love if you came to visit me in Eretz Yisrael. I'll show you around. I'll take you to the Kotel. I'll show you certain places. He has. He hadn't been there in 25 or 30 years. This was about 19 years ago. I said, why haven't you been there? He said, because if I go there, I feel that I would cheapen Eretz Yisrael. Going with my camera, taking pictures, going to touristy sites. It's Eretz HaKodesh. It's a land of Kedushin. I'm going to go there and trivialize it with cameras and photo ops and touristy things. So my first reaction was, I was very impressed with this blazing intensity, with this incredible passion to live Eretz Yisrael that I didn't have. Then I walked away saying, what price is he paying? Price he pays. He hasn't been Eretz Yisrael 25 years or 30 years, or ever was at that point. So there's always a challenge in life. That something should be pitched and intense, but it should also be real. And the truth is, in this yeshiva, we struggle with that a lot. So you say, well, maybe in yeshiva I should only learn an hour a day or 2 hours a day, because after all, that's the max anyone's going to learn here, unless they become a Rebbe or a Kollel person. Our goal is to give you the chops and the skills and the orientations that one day in 15 years, you'll learn an hour a day, you'll dive in three times a day with Dominion, you'll have dedicated halachic fidelity. That's our goal here. So if yeshiva becomes too fantastical and too different, then it won't impact the after yeshiva experience. And it's true. But on the other hand, without the intensity of yeshiva, you won't have the time to develop those conditionings and those orientations and those passions that hopefully will continue to burn in your heart, even when you don't have the opportunity to express it all day. But even yeshiva, if yeshiva is just a cloistered, sequestered, insulated, isolated environment that has no bearing on reality, then it's very easy to be firm in yeshiva. But you all know the boys that are very firm in yeshiva, and they walk away and they lose all their commitment, they lose all their intensity. I think what this yeshiva does well is it straddles the fence. We try to create as deep an environment as we can for you in the Beis Medrash, but first of all, the fact that we live in a community makes it, I hope, a little bit more real. You'll see adults, you interact with adults, you visit their homes. You feel as if you're part of a holistic fabric. This isn't just a mountain with a building on it, but you're part of a larger movement, a larger community, a larger ideology. One of the events I didn't mention before that I want everyone, if you miss this event, I promise you you'll have deep regrets 20 years from now, if not 10 years from now. As you know, Lichtenstein is receiving next week the Israel Prize, which is one of the highest, if not the highest, non-military prize awarded in the country. Is one of the people receiving it this year. And it's actually the first time that a Rosh Hashiva is receiving the award for his Torah activity. There are two Rosh Hashivas who have received the award before, and it's generally designated or relegated to secular figures, actors, politicians, scientists, people that have achieved, so to speak, in the general population, in the general culture. The two Rosh Hashivas who have received it before, one is Rav Sabato, who received it for the books he authored, not the Torah he wrote necessarily, but he wrote some incredible novels about Israel experience, and you may have read them, about his experience with the Yom Kippur War. He's a Rebbe in Malay Adumim. And Rav Grossman, who received it for his charity work in Migdal Or, which up north he has a whole charity organization. But this is the first time, and who knows, the last time maybe, that a Rosh Hashiva is receiving the top prize in Israel for Torah. That's an incredible Kiddush Hashem, anyway you slice it. that this country is willing to recognize Torah as something that we should be proud of, and Torah accomplishment. So he'll receive the prize next Tuesday on Yom HaTzmaut with all the other people who are receiving the prize. By the way, one of the people of note who's receiving the prize is Rav Avadya Yosef's daughter, for all of her work in trying to create educational frameworks for Haredi women. She's been very active in creating alternate educational frameworks for Haredi girls who don't want to go to classic university settings. So she'll also be receiving. And Dina Bar Shalom is her name. So just if you read about it in the newspaper, it's a very important award also, because it's our community. It's a Dati community. So on Thursday, we're going to have a congregation, I can't even call it a party, of hundreds, I'd say thousands of Gush alumni. We're going to come to just acknowledge it. We're seeing this receiving the award. There'll be speeches, there'll be dancing, there'll be some food, there'll be starting more or less at around 4 on Thursday. So it's really not something you want to miss. It's a real history moment. But the reason I'm calling it to your attention is one of the things I hope you'll notice is that being in this yeshiva makes you part of a larger community of people that have been in this yeshiva for the last 45 years. You're going to feel automatically there'll be people that are older than your grandparents that are going to walk into this building on Thursday, and they're going to feel immediately identified with you. Oh, I was here in 1973, you're here in 2013. We're only 40 years apart. You know, we only came to this yeshiva 40 years apart. And you're going to feel an immediate connection to these people. You're going to see this is a yeshiva that isn't just a building on a mountain. It's part of something a little bit larger. A community of movement, a larger virtual community in Eretz Yisrael, people that really feel very, very deeply to this yeshiva, committed to the yeshiva, 10s, 20s, 30 years after they left yeshiva. So that's the first medrash about why these animals are selected. These animals are selected because Hashem doesn't want to paint religion as a trip to some other place, as a trip to some other you. That's also part of the challenge for people in yeshiva. You want to change, but if the change is too artificial, it won't stick. So you want to change, but the change has to be holistic, the change has to be gradual, the change has to be internal, rather than put on a certain type of clothing, or wear your tzitzis a little longer, or go through motions. Change has to be real and authentic and genuine for it to really stick long term. So Hashem is trying to develop a message. Don't think that religion means leaving your reality, your place, your home, your homestead, your farm, and going to some jungle, whether it's an actual jungle, or whether it's some experiential and metaphoric jungle, or desert, or sea. Just go into your backyard. Do what you do, but just do it well. One of the great lessons that Rav Amital, as a Kohen Brachah, would always repeat to us, and we're a little bit late on this one, but I want to slip it in. Parshas Kedoshim begins with a very ambitious, one could call it an audacious, demand. Kedoshim to you. What's the end of the pasuk? Ki Kadoshim Yeshem Elokechem. Actually, someone sent me today a Dvar Torah. They sent me an email. Here's a good Dvar Torah in Kedoshim. It was a day late, but they sent it to me, so I was expecting to see a Dvar Torah, and I keep downloading. There's an image. I think the image is probably just a link to some Dvar Torah. I keep downloading, and all I get is an image. Then I looked at the image. It's a very cute image. It's just a little box that had the words Kedoshim to you. Ki Kadoshim Yeshem Elokechem, and then two words. No pressure. No, be Kadosh, because I'm Kadosh. Hashem's Kadosh. Don't feel any pressure now to be like me. Kadoshim to you, to your Kadosh, and Hashem. Okay, come see, you think, what does it mean to be a Kadosh? To be a Nazir, to be a monk, to separate yourself from reality, to bring korbanos, to learn Torah all day, to dip in the mikvah, to only eat bread and water. If you read through Parshas Kadoshim, you see that the list is very, very common. Keep it avayim, morality, don't lie, don't cheat, don't exploit people, don't curse a person who can't handle, to tell charish, look at the Iver, look at the Nishal, look at Shakaru, look at Kachashu, if they say Vatakum, Vedar to Kadeh Zakein, look at Sasachicha Bil Vavecha. The Vatakal always told us, don't think that Kadusha means becoming someone else other than who you are. Just do what you do, but do it for Hashem. Do what you do and do it well. Do whatever most people do, there's some common moral impulse, but just do it well, be committed to it, and strive for excellence in that sphere. Now, what's the second? I don't have my watch on me, but what's the second? What's the second medrash I wanted to get to? Take a look at the bottom. We're going to get to two medrashim today. Source number Gimel, part one. Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra Amar. Rabbi Lezer Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra said a different reason that these animals are chosen. After korbanos kein, Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu. The animals that you're bringing on the mizbeach, they're not predators; they're prey. Line two, shor, an ox, near dafter bnei ari, is preyed upon by a lion. Az, eis, a goat, mifnei namer, who preys on goats, leopards. Keves, who preys on sheep, zeiv, wolves. Hashem says, I don't want predators on the Mizbech. I want prey. I want a shore on the Mizbech, not a lion. I want a kevas on the Mizbech, not a wolf. I want a goat on the Mizbech, not a leopard. This is a really important message for two reasons. Because of the message itself, because of the danger of misinterpreting the message. So first I'll talk about the danger, then we'll get to the message. Hashem wants prey, not predators. Hashem doesn't want these animals that are vicious and aggressive and predate on other animals. That's not the way Hashem wants to carpet. Hashem wants victims, prey. That could lead people towards the celebration of victimhood. It's good to be a victim. Victimhood is good. Take one for the team. Take one because Hashem wants you to have it that way. And a lot of people struggle with that about the Holocaust. Did they respond? Why did they try to retaliate? And a lot of people focus all their attention on the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising because that's one of the most glaring moments of Jewish resistance. They have a harder time processing, celebrating, heroicizing those people who didn't have the opportunity to strike back. One of the things Rav Amital taught us, again I mentioned Rav Amital, don't even try. As someone that went through the Holocaust in its full fury, don't even try to wrap your head or your mind around the Holocaust. Certainly not to judge people before you walk a mile in their shoes. Those of you who went to Poland, you can begin to identify with the suffering and the psychological warfare. Our little mind tends to condense the Holocaust into cartoonish dimensions. When you realize the amount of people, and you realize the machinery that was assembled against our people, you realize how impotent and how incapable so many Jews were of mounting what we would expect to be a more thorough and widespread retaliation, or at least resistance. But not just in Holocaust imagery. Very often, people think about victimization, and they celebrate victimization, because it releases them from challenge and responsibility. I remember hearing about 10 years ago, a member of the African-American community. I think his name is Larry Elders. And he was commenting upon the African-American community in America. And every time they hit a crisis in their community, they always celebrate their victimhood. Well, the reason that we have so many single-parent families, or that we're so rife with drugs or crime, he was saying on behalf of his community, is because the white man enslaved us 150 years ago. At some point, you have to take accountability. At some point, you have to be responsible for your own community. And this ideal ethic of victimhood, where we were the victims, and every fissure in our society can be imputed to our victimhood, that's self-acquitting rather than self-empowering. Self-empowering says, okay, we may be the victims, but now we're going to empower ourselves to take control of our situation and respond to our delinquencies, or respond to our deficiencies and try to improve it. One could claim that in some areas of Judaism, there still is an inclination towards victimization, and people aren't able to transition. Baruch Hashem, we now live in a period which we no longer are victims of history. We can empower ourselves and defend ourselves and defend our rights and defend our country and defend our people. And some people have a difficult time processing that. Maybe a psychological, not just an ideological inhibition. Some people are ideological, Hashem doesn't want to serve in the army, serving the army is biblical Torah, serving the army. But for some people, it may just be an inability to shift from 2,000s of years of victimhood into a modern era in which we no longer have to be the victims as best that we can. We can try to defend our rights and assert our rights and prosecute our rights. It's not just true at the national level or at the historical level. It's also true at the personal level. Unfortunately, one of the challenges you'll all have to face as adults are various forms of abuse that are becoming more and more common in our society. Whether it's physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, social media abuse, and our collective responsibility, marital abuse, iguna, our collective responsibility is to try as best we can, as responsibly as we can, to oppose it and to eliminate it. But if you are a victim of abuse, or someone you know is a victim of abuse, very often the victims of abuse justify by saying, well, I deserve it. That's why so many victims of abuse are people with low self-esteem. Very often, one of the great ironies of abuse is both the abuser and the abusee are both people with low self-esteem. People with healthy self-esteem tend not to be abusers nor victims of abuse. People with low self-esteem tend to be abusers. They need to get it artificially by beating someone up or saying negative or being violent or lording over another human being. And ironically, They're also victims of abuse because they don't have enough self-esteem to say, I don't deserve this. I'm a better person. I don't deserve this abuse. I don't deserve this in my marriage. I don't deserve this in my friendship. I don't deserve this in my relationship with my rabbi. I don't deserve this. People with healthy self-esteem, they don't need to abuse people, nor they tend to be those who perpetuate abuse. So there's no celebration of victimhood in Yiddishkeit. Hashem doesn't want people to be victims. There's no idolization of the victim. Chas v'shalom. And if you're able to help people and to identify people that are victims of abuse, it could be subtle, it could be very, very glaring, it could be very, very pronounced. That's one of the major responsibilities, to do it in a responsible fashion. Just, I know we don't have that much time, but I'll give you one or two examples. I remember I was approached, I once walked by a house, this was about 20 years ago on a lunch, but every day I walked by that house in the morning on the way to shul, I heard this loud screaming between the husband and wife and at the kids. I got really scared. So my first inclination was maybe call someone. I said, you know, let me find out a little bit. Let me investigate. So I spoke to the neighbors who were able to see them in a more organic setting. They said, oh, they love each other. They're a great family. They just scream. That's their nature. They're big screamers. I left it in Berkshire. They're fine. Then. And so if I would have gone in there screaming and calling police and calling social workers, I would have ruined a perfectly good home setting. You have to first do your homework. You have to be very, very discreet about things. Remember someone once approached me. I was twice approached by young women who said that they had come into contact with rabbinic/educational figures who abused the male-female boundaries with them. And instead of calling the police or starting a witch hunt, I delicately called people that were involved with them in the educational field. And in one case, I was told, yeah, we're aware of it, but not really the way it's described. We're just not aware of his social interactions, and we're aware of the situation. In another case, I called someone who was affiliated with the same institution that person was affiliated with. And I said, look, I'm giving it to you. I trust you. I don't want to make a big deal about this, but you have the responsibility now. Without all of a sudden ruining people's career and hurling false accusations at people. I know people, you know, we always indict and we always feel hatred, and as we should, and disappointment at people that are convicted and exposed as abusive. But there are equal amount of people whose lives have been ruined by false accusations of abuse. And I can tell you personal horrors, not personal in terms of myself, Baruch Hashem, but talmidim of mine, whose lives have been shattered by false accusations that I've had to deal with and help them through. So you're in a position which you have to be sensitive to the issue, but you have to deal with it in a responsible fashion. Not shooting from the hip, not being impetuous, not being rash or unthought or unmeditated about it. But the message of this medrash, if we ignore the danger of exaggerating this message, the message of the Medrash is Hashem does not want aggression. You can't become more religious. You can't walk up to the Mizbeach with a predator. You have to walk up the Mizbeach with a passive animal, not a predator. And what does it mean to be aggressive? No one in this room is a predator. No one in this room is running around killing goats. No one in this room is running around killing sheep. No one in this room is running around killing oxen. Where in our lives are we aggressive? When we're aggressive, a lot of you are starting to drive. Are you a responsible, sensitive, considerate driver? Are you an aggressive driver? In some cases, we become very aggressive in driving. You have to be careful, obviously, for your own safety, but even more so for the safety of those around you. A member of Amital once gave a sicha about driving, about this issue. We didn't quote this medrash. He gave a sicha to the whole base medrash in which he implored us to drive carefully, drive responsibly, give the right of way, don't be aggressive in our driving. I was already in the kollel, so I got into my car after the sicha, and I was driving to Yerushalayim to take care of something. Who do I see behind me in the rearview mirror? Rav Amital. You should have seen how slowly I drove that day. I was double signaling each time I made a turn, giving the right of way to Bubby, Zadies, camels, ants, rodents, garbage trucks. I got to Yerushalayim about two and a half hours to get to Yerushalayim that day. I'm sure Rav Amital was like, why is the guy driving so slow? I got to get to Yerushalayim. I wasn't going to take any shortcuts that day. In general, when we share space, the Beis Medrash is a place for you. Obviously, you want to learn in the Beis Medrash with passion, with excitement. Sometimes that excitement spills over into being loud, into being colorful, into being graphic, into being livid, into having loud conversations. But you want to be mindful of people in your surroundings, that you don't take away their sanity and their ability to focus. When you daven, you obviously want to feel a certain degree of freedom, to shake as you like, to say whatever loud or soft davening, but you want to be very careful that your davening doesn't stand in the way of another person's davening, because you're shaking too much, you're making too many sounds, or you're kriyat shema, because you want to hear every single word. is preventing another person from focusing on Kriya Shema. But there are other ways that we've learned to become aggressive. We live in a very aggressive culture. Listen to the language. Look at the sports, right? Sports figures used to celebrate their sports accomplishments by shaking each other's hand, by giving a high five, by giving each other a hug. Today it's very common in sports figures to give primal screams, you know, to scream at the top of their lungs or pull out their jersey or to do something really violent intending towards another person. So to the degree that it helps you play a little better, of course, but to the degree that it encourages aggressive behavior, bullying, and to the degree that this is contagious and starts to filtrate through our society, social media has opened a whole new area of bullying where you can say something that's negative about another person. And even if you don't say it in the same harsh and bullish terms that was commonly associated with bullying, the mere volume of people that are reading what you're saying turns it into a violent and aggressive act. You can really make them hear people. I'm sure you guys have been following better than I have. People who have committed suicide have taken their own lives because they've been so distressed over actual bullying or over social media type bullying. Because so many people find out about their whatever. They dressed this way. They said this thing. They were embarrassed in a certain way. How do you talk in a room? Do you scream at someone? How do you eat at the table? Do you eat with manners? Obviously, you don't have to sit there and cut every piece of meat in classic English style. You don't have to sit there and make believe you're sitting in a museum, but do you sit at the table and eat with proper manners, proper respect to those around you, making sure your area is clean, making sure when you get up your area is clean, making sure you push your chair back on the table, you consider it to others, rather than just getting up and walking your own way. So part of the shift that takes place for Ben Torah is not just how many Blat Gemara you learn, or how you daven Shmoneh Esrei, or how often you come to Minyan, although those are the more obvious objective metrics, but it's who you are as a person. And one of the areas of who you are as a person that has to be thought of carefully as you go through yeshiva is, are you becoming someone that's a little softer, a little less cynical, a little less sarcastic, a little less biting, a little less aggressive? Certainly, I would hope at this stage, you know, when you're in high school, sometimes when you have a confrontation with another boy, especially, and you feel frustrated and you're not able to resolve the confrontation, sometimes, I hope it doesn't happen that much, but sometimes you see that it expresses itself in actual fistfights or physical force. I would hope already at this point, you're at the stage where you're able to realize the futility of using physical force to solve a crisis or a confrontation. And now you can start working on other expressions of violence. Speaking loud, shouting, or giving shiur to women, I give a different shiur about the aggression. But, you know, certainly it's a time to start thinking about you don't solve problems with shouting out the other person. You don't solve problems with raising your voice. You don't solve problems with screaming or saying something negative about the other person. And it's a shame. This is a good time to especially prepare yourselves for marriage and for dating and for one of the hardest male-female encounters is when a male starts to act violent at all different levels, whether it's physical chas v'shalom violence, sexual violence, verbal violence, behavioral violence. Very hard for females to handle because a male just has a certain level of strength that females don't have, and it can become very scary and very frightening to women. So even in my own house at a very early age, when one of my boys, I think a couple of years ago, had some run-in with one of my girls, whatever, it was about something stupid, pancakes or French toast, whatever it was, and they started raising their voice, I very rarely intervened with such force and with such frontal intervention. I took that boy aside and I said, you will absolutely never, ever raise your voice to a woman. You will absolutely never, ever use your male strength as a leverage point in resolving crisis in general, but certainly not with a woman who doesn't have that. I'd be very scared by that. And Baruch Hashem, it was a lesson that they picked up very quickly and has never been used again because I intervened so powerfully and so dramatically at that moment. So Parshas Emor is a moment to think about making religion real and authentic, not artificial, jungles, shaking when you read Hashem's constitution, but trying to make it integrated and fused to your reality. It's also a Parsha to think about that Hashem does not want predators on the Mizbeach. You can't become from if you're aggressive. You have to become less aggressive. Now, being less aggressive doesn't mean you're a patsy, doesn't mean you're, in common parlance, you're a sucker or you let people exploit you. But it means that you try to pursue your needs, but not in violent, aggressive, manipulative fashion. Let's talk here. Yeah.